Welcome to Unveiled Faces, a Redeemer Presbyterian Church podcast. Please enjoy our feature presentation.
When we looked at Genesis 1 and 2 last Sunday, we saw that God gave mankind the work of filling the earth, subduing the earth, and ruling over the earth. And while this point is obvious, it needs to be stated that the work was given prior to the fall of man. And therefore, we must not think of work as a curse. Work is not a punishment. Rather, work is how we serve God. It's how our lives are able to reflect his righteous character. And when we work in ways that imitate God, we bring him glory. And this is the beginning of the biblical work ethic. And by way of review, the biblical work ethic doesn't merely govern the way we work for our employers. That's too narrow a definition of the work that God has given us. The biblical work ethic teaches us that we are to serve God in all areas of our lives. And this includes the work that he has given us to perform in our marriage and in our family and in our private life, in our school, in our church, in our community, and yes, in our employment. Another point of review is that the biblical work ethic ascribes dignity and value to all righteous labor. There's no such thing as righteous labor which is dishonorable or shameful or undignified. When performed righteously, all work is honorable and all work is valuable because it contributes to God's assignment of filling, subduing, and ruling the earth. The Christian who is working righteously, therefore, must never be thought of doing work which is second class. That's not a distinction that fits within the biblical worldview. Well, that's what we learned last week. And the focus was primarily on the work that God had assigned to mankind before the fall, while Adam and Eve were still working in the Garden of Eden. Today, I want us to look at the work that God has assigned to mankind after the fall, that is, outside the Garden of Eden. The job assignment has not changed. Let's be clear about that. The work of filling, subduing, and ruling that God gave to Adam prior to the fall is the same assignment that God gave to Noah after the fall. Compare Genesis 1 with Genesis 9, and you'll see that the job assignment remains the same. So what has changed is the work that we are to complete has become significantly more difficult. And because of sin, all creation is groaning in the bondage of corruption. All creation is groaning in the bondage of corruption. And this means the earth is in rebellion. It doesn't want to be filled. It doesn't want to be subdued, and it doesn't want to be ruled over, yet that remains our job. And so with much diligence and with much difficulty, we pursue this assignment that God has given to us. Now, in the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon wrestles with the implications of Adam's sin on this job assignment that we have to fill, subdue, and rule the earth. And Solomon knows that in this fallen world, work is painful and frustrating. He knows that we work a life of painful and frustrating labor, and then we die. This fact is not overlooked by Solomon. And so he writes about his meditations and contemplations concerning the toilsome life of man outside of Eden, and Solomon writes with complete honesty. He doesn't try to sugarcoat anything. He comes right out at the very beginning of the book in Ecclesiastes 1:3 by asking whether there is any meaning or value in the work we perform. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? That's the question. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? And Solomon uses the entire book of Ecclesiastes to answer this question. In fact, he answers the question 7 times. Over the course of 12 chapters, Solomon goes through 7 different cycles or 7 different repetitions of asking and answering this very question. And seven times, Solomon recognizes that there's a great deal of vanity, a great deal of emptiness in the way fallen man goes about his work. But seven times, Solomon also concludes that it doesn't need to be that way. Seven times, Solomon concludes that those who labor in accordance with the biblical work ethic experience joy and satisfaction and blessing in their work. The book of Ecclesiastes, therefore, is about work ethic. But here's an important point to understanding the book. Solomon doesn't simply put forth the biblical work ethic and say, here, go do this. Rather, he shows us what happens when man abandons the biblical work ethic. Because of the corruption of sin, our fallen human nature has distorted values. And these distorted values cause us to prioritize the wrong goals, goals that God never told us to work toward. And when we prioritize the wrong goals, we end up structuring all of our work around the wrong thing, the wrong goals. And rather than structuring all of our work around filling, subduing, and ruling the earth to the glory of God, we end up creating a competing work ethic that structures our work around assignments that God never gave us to do. Our sermon text from Ecclesiastes 2 belongs to the first of those seven cycles that run through the book of Ecclesiastes. And in this first cycle, Solomon answers the question of whether there's profit in man's labor by testing four of the unbiblical work ethics that are common to man. He experiments with these different work ethics. He doesn't just analyze them from a distance. He actually immerses himself into the work ethic and lives it out to its logical end. It's kind of like learning a new language. You can learn a language in the classroom, or you can learn a language by immersing yourself in a culture that speaks the language you want to learn. Immersion has a lot of advantages. It's the quickest and most authentic way to learn a language. Well, Solomon uses the immersion strategy to learn whether these four different work ethics enable man to profit from his toil under the sun. In other words, Solomon immerses himself in these four different work ethics to see if they provide any meaningful work experience. The first immersion experiment is described in verse 1. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure. Now, children, if you don't know what the word mirth means, it means fun and laughter. Solomon is saying, I'm going to experiment with fun and laughter. I'm going to experiment with a work ethic which places its highest value on pursuing personal pleasure. And I'm going to see what that produces, where that leads to. We can call this the working for the weekend work ethic. The working for the weekend work ethic. And what did Solomon conclude about the working for the weekend work ethic? Look at the end of verse 1. But surely this also was vanity. I said of laughter, madness, and of mirth. What does it accomplish? The word madness means to be made to look foolish. That's what the Hebrew actually is saying there. To be made to look foolish. Solomon is saying that the person who places too high a value on fun and laughter is a person who will be made to look foolish to other people. How so? Because in the grand scheme of things, fun and laughter don't accomplish anything. This is why Solomon immediately follows that statement with a rhetorical question. What does it accomplish? Or as the ESV puts it, what use is it? This fun and laughter. What does it accomplish? Let me try to illustrate. Have you ever attempted to have a serious conversation with somebody who only seems interested in cracking jokes? You try to bring the conversation down to a deeper level, but the person keeps bringing it back up to the surface by making little jokes and wisecracks. And you walk away from that conversation feeling like you really didn't have a conversation. Words were exchanged, but there was no depth of meaning to them. The interchange didn't produce anything substantive within your heart and your soul. It was, at best, just a few laughs. That's the type of emptiness that the working for the weekend work ethic produces. Solomon is saying that the person who works hard so that he can play hard doesn't actually accomplish anything substantive or meaningful in life. He places too high a value on fun and laughter. And because his goal is to have fun, he eventually shows himself to be foolish to those who are around him who are pursuing more righteous goals. Understand, the Bible doesn't condemn fun and laughter. In the very next chapter, Solomon wrote that there is a time to weep and a time to laugh. So there is a time for fun and laughter. But sanctified wisdom informs us that fun and laughter are the condiments in life and not the food. Fun and laughter are the condiments in life and not the food. Condiments are meant to enhance the flavor of the food, but not to be a substitute for the food. So we use condiments sparingly. Have you ever put too much mustard on your hot dog? Have you ever put too much horseradish on your steak? And we use condiments with discretion. You don't put wasabi on your pancakes, nor do you put mayonnaise on your breakfast cereal. Fun and laughter have their place, but as the condiments that enhance the real food of filling, subduing, and ruling the earth to the glory of God. Solomon is telling us that the working for the weekend work ethic does not end well. It is madness. It is vanity. It does not accomplish anything. Now, as we're listening to Solomon describe his experience with these immersion experiments, here's something to keep in mind. If there was anybody in the world who was in a good position to perform these types of experiments, it was Solomon. Solomon was the king, and he was an extremely wealthy king, so he had all the resources he needed to carry out his experiments. Moreover, Solomon ruled in a time of peace, so he didn't have the distractions of warfare or other urgent matters to take him away from these experiments. He had everything he needed to fully immerse himself in whatever he wanted to immerse himself in. He had the time, he had the money, he had command over his entire kingdom. So when Solomon immersed himself in a work ethic, he was able to do it to its fullest and to its completion. If I tried to conduct these experiments, I wouldn't be able to pull it off very well. I don't have the financial resources that are needed to fully pursue these things. I don't have the freedom over my time to fully pursue these things, nor do I have an entire kingdom of people that I can enlist to assist me in these experiments. And so Solomon was able to conduct these experiments much, much better than I could. And I suspect much, much better than you could. Now, this is an important consideration because if I'm going down the wrong path, pursuing the wrong work ethic, it's inevitable that I'm going to experience some form of emptiness, right? For example, if I've adopted the working for the weekend work ethic, I'm eventually going to experience the vanity and madness that Solomon says it is. But here's the danger. When I eventually realize that the working hard so I can play hard mentality is not producing the results that I thought it would, I'm much more likely to believe that it's because I have not been able to dedicate enough of my time and enough of my money and enough of my other resources to pursue the pleasure. Right? In other words, I'm going to conclude that the reason my pleasure-seeking heart is unfulfilled is because I haven't been able to achieve enough pleasure in my life. I have these impediments around me. And so rather than abandoning the working for the weekend work ethic, I'm going to try to pursue pleasure all the more diligently. And this is going to create a vicious cycle. The pursuit of pleasure will feed more emptiness, and more emptiness will feed a deeper desire to pursue pleasure. In God's good providence to us, he positioned Solomon to show us where these unbiblical work ethics will lead if they are pursued to their fullest. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. The second immersion experiment Solomon describes in our sermon text is in verse 3. I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine, while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. Now, when Solomon says it, that he guided his heart with wisdom while searching how to gratify his flesh with wine, he's saying that he didn't just indiscriminately overindulge himself in wine, like the way an alcoholic would pursue drunkenness. Rather, Solomon searched how to gratify his flesh with wine in the way a connoisseur does. He drank with discretion and moderation, not trying to become intoxicated, but trying to enjoy the flavor and aroma and sensual pleasures of the wine. Solomon was that guy in the tasting room holding up the glass of wine, analyzing the color of the wine, swirling it, smelling it, letting the aroma linger as he tries to identify the elements of the terroir. And all the while he's contemplating these things, he eventually will come around to actually tasting the wine, and in a small amount, and maybe he'll even spit it out. We can call this the foodie work ethic. The foodie is a person who will work for food, only he has a discriminating palate. He won't settle for just any food. He wants gourmet food. He wants finely aged wine. And the foodie doesn't just eat and drink because he's hungry and thirsty. He eats and drinks because he has an ardent desire to gratify his flesh with tasty delights. Solomon immersed himself into the foodie work ethic, directing all his toilsome labors to the production and acquisition of savory delicacies that will dance upon his tongue. And what did he conclude of the foodie work ethic? That it brings no real joy or satisfaction. That it is empty. It is vanity. It leads to nothing. In fact, this experiment in the foodie work ethic may have had something to do with what Solomon wrote in Proverbs 23, verses 31 and 32. Do not look on the wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it swirls around smoothly. At last, it bites like a serpent and stings like a viper. Solomon's third immersion experiment is recorded in verses 4 through 11. And here Solomon works to achieve material success. He builds houses. He plants vineyards. He establishes gardens and orchards. He dug a water pond. He acquired lots of servants, lots of cattle, lots of silver and gold. He hired musicians to perform for him. He wrote in verse 10, whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, as it was my reward from all my labor. Now we can call this one the home and garden work ethic. The home and garden work ethic. And it's the notion that the goal of our work is to attain a beautiful home with a gorgeous yard. Or it's the notion that the goal of our work is to build a prosperous business or to establish an expansive farming enterprise. Now, judging from what Solomon wrote in verse 10, it sounds like this home and garden work ethic brought him joy, right? Solomon specifically says, my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. But the rejoicing in his heart was fleeting. It was short-lived. We need to continue reading what he wrote in verse 11, for that's where he offers his final conclusion about the home and garden work ethic. Then I looked on all the work of my hands had done, and on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. This is where the Christian might meet with some confusion. You might ask, what's wrong with living in a nice home? What's wrong with building a prosperous business? What's wrong with large-scale farming? Don't these things fall within God's assignment of filling, subduing, and ruling the earth? Aren't gardens and vineyards and orchards and ponds part of the work that God gave us to do? And these are relevant questions because it seems like the home and garden work ethic is the exact imitation of what God did in the Garden of Eden. And it seems like this is exactly what God told Adam to do over the entire surface of the earth. So why would Solomon say that the home and garden work ethic is vanity and grasping for the wind? Here's where we need to be careful readers of what Solomon wrote. And the reason the home and garden work ethic is not the biblical work ethic has very little to do with the type of work that's being performed and has everything to do with who the work is being performed for. Is the person who plants the orchard doing it for God or for himself? Is the person who builds the garden doing it for God or for himself? Solomon's experiment was in doing all of these things for himself. If we carefully reread his description of the work he performed, we'll see that Solomon heavily emphasizes that all of this is being done for himself. Let's start back at verse 4. I made my works great. I built myself houses. I planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards. I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water ponds from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and of provinces. Do you see the emphasis Solomon is putting upon himself? Do you see how everything he did was for himself? There's no mention of doing these things to the glory of God. There's no mention of doing these things as part of humanity's larger effort to fill, subdue, and rule the world in a way that reflects the character of God. What makes the home and garden work ethic vanity and a grasping at the wind is the selfishness and its materialism, right? The selfishness and the materialism. The goal is to find meaning and fulfillment in the beautiful home, according to the home and garden work ethic. Right? The goal is to find meaning and fulfillment in a beautiful home with a beautiful garden and a beautiful pond with beautiful trees and beautiful flowers. Or, to put it in slightly different terms, the goal of the home and garden work ethic is to find meaning and fulfillment in material objects. Or, to put it in slightly different terms, the goal is to find meaning and fulfillment by storing up treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. We can understand why Solomon's initial reaction to the home and garden work ethic was to rejoice in the work of his hands. It's because outwardly, the home and garden work ethic looks and feels a lot like the biblical work ethic. It's creating like God created. It's adding beauty to the world like God added beauty to the world. It's bringing order and design and knowledge and planning and artistry together in a way that displays intelligence. But it's the inner components of the home and garden work ethic that are flawed. The one performing the work is not intending to honor God with his work. He's intending to honor himself. The things that are constructed are not intended to be Ebenezers of God's gracious provision to man, but rather they are wood and stone idols that cannot speak or hear or save a person from their sin. The home and garden work ethic is an imposter. that looks a lot like the biblical work ethic, but it ultimately brings forth destruction. For what profit is it to a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Isn't that the same question Solomon asked at the beginning of Ecclesiastes? What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? Certainly, if a man toils under the sun and this causes him to lose his soul, then there's no profit in it at all. And it's no surprise, therefore, that Solomon concludes the home and garden work ethic is vanity and grasping for the wind, because the home and garden work ethic is established upon idolatry and materialism. The fourth immersion experiment that Solomon performs in our sermon text is a bit more philosophical than the others. We can call this one the existential work ethic. The existential work ethic. Look at verse 12. Then I turned myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can a man do who succeeds the king? Only what he has already done. Now, this is the starting point for the existential work ethic. What I want you to notice is that it is unabashedly established in pride. The question that's being asked is, how can a man distinguish himself above every other person? How can a man who follows after a great king prove himself to be greater than that great king? And the immediate concession that Solomon makes is that it's not possible for anybody to distinguish himself through material enterprises. He says, whatever great feat you set out to do, somebody else has already done it before you. You can construct an enormous building, but somebody else has already done that. You can lead an army to defeat a great nation, but somebody else has already done that. You can acquire large amounts of silver and gold, but somebody else has already done that. No matter what you try to do, somebody else has already done it. So Solomon contemplates, if the goal is to distinguish myself above others, then what option does that leave? And he discovers his answer in verse 13. Then I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. According to the existential work ethic, it is by use of the intellect that a person can distinguish himself. It is through superior feats of thinking that one can rise above others in new ways. So forget about trying to outdo each other through feats of brawn. You can outdo each other through feats of brain. Now, obviously, there's an enormous amount of pride being espoused here. The idea that our work should be a competition with everybody else in the world is a very American way of looking at things, but it's not a biblical way of looking at things. Certainly, the biblical work ethic demands that we do all of our work to the best of our ability. So in that regard, we do seek to work with excellence, but not so that we can be praised by man, not so that we can think of ourselves as better than others, or that we can memorialize our fame and status for ages to come. The biblical work ethic teaches us that we should always be working for the glory of God, which means there will be occasions when we need to step out of the spotlight. Our goal is never to magnify ourselves, it's to magnify God. He must increase and I must decrease. So we can immediately see that the existential work ethic is established in sinful pride and arrogance. And because it's established in sinful pride and arrogance, we need to reject it. We need to dismiss it. But having immersed himself in this experiment, Solomon shows us where that pride and arrogance will ultimately lead if a person is so foolish as to actually pursue it. Verse 14b, yet I myself perceived that the same event happens to them all. So I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, it also happens to me. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart, this also is vanity. For there is no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever. since all that now is will be forgotten in the days to come. And how does a wise man die? As the fool. The existential work ethic, therefore, always, always, always leads to despair. It will always lead to a meaningless existence. No matter how far above other people one may think he distinguishes himself, he eventually dies just like every other person in this world. How does the wise man die, Solomon asks, in the same way that the fool dies? Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? The existential work ethic is the foolishness of this world. Beware lest anyone cheat you through philosophy and empty deceit, according to the traditions of men, according to the basic principles of the world, and not according to Christ. Now, having conducted these immersion experiments in four different work ethics, Solomon concludes that they're all vanity, all four of them. They're all empty. They're all grasping for the wind. They're all deficient for the sole reason that they remove God from the center of the work ethic and replace him with something else. The working for the weekend work ethic replaces God with fun and laughter. The foodie work ethic replaces God with the gratification of the flesh. The home and garden work ethic replaces God with idolatrous materialism. And the existential work ethic replaces God with vainglory, with the inordinate pride of oneself and one's achievements. Now, having experimented with these work ethics that displace God from the center, Solomon draws his final conclusions here at the end of the chapter. And he says in verse 24, nothing is better for a man than he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. Now, upon first reading, you might be thinking, wait, Solomon, you just proved that there's no real satisfaction in eating and drinking or in rejoicing in the labor of your hands. And now you're saying that there's nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor? But Solomon's not contradicting himself here. Notice the last sentence in verse 24. Solomon says that the man's ability to enjoy these things is a gift from the hand of God. And this is the first time in this chapter that Solomon mentions God. And understandably so, because the four work ethics he was experimenting with excluded God. But now that Solomon is turning his attention to the biblical work ethic, he says that the ability for a person's soul to enjoy food and drink and good in his labor is a gift from God. Solomon repeats this concept in verse 26. He writes, for God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight. All right, what Solomon has concluded through these experiments is that if we displace God from the center of our work ethic, then everything good in life, pleasure, food, possessions, our personal achievements, everything good in life will slip through our fingers like wind running through our fingers. They don't satisfy. They don't fulfill us. They don't contribute to our sense of meaning and purpose in this world. But if we seek first the kingdom of God, then all these things will be added to us. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights. And when God is at the center of our work ethic, he graciously gives us the ability to eat and drink with satisfaction. He makes it so that our soul rejoices in the labor of our hands. He gives laughter in a time of feasting. He gives joy and contentment with our daily provision of bread. Our homes, whether humble or ornate, are a place of peace and joy and love. Our gardens, whether they spread out over acres or they rest on our windowsill, they bring genuine satisfaction to our heart. And those who are gifted with physical strength will experience meaning and purpose when they use that strength to honor God. And those who are gifted with intellectual strength will experience meaning and purpose when they use that strength to honor God. when our toilsome labor under the sun is structured around the biblical work ethic, there is no such thing as dissatisfying work. There is no such thing as dishonorable work or shameful work or undignified work. When performed righteously, all work is honorable, all work is valuable, and all our work will bring meaning and satisfaction and contentment to our own personal lives, because the God who is at the center of our work ethic loves us and desires to give us good gifts. Amen.
This has been a presentation of Redeemer Presbyterian Church. For more resources and information, please stop by our website at visitredeemer.org. All material here within, unless otherwise noted, copyright Redeemer Presbyterian Church, Elk Grove, California. Music furnished by Nathan Clark George, available at nathanclarkgeorge.com.